The nasty fear rose in his chest, and he called, "For Christ's sake, Nadine, look out where you're going." She was concentrating on the Honda's hand controls, not looking where she was going, and she was going to drive directly into a pine tree at a wobbling 5 miles an hour. She looked up, and he heard her say, "Oh," in a startled voice. She swerved the bike, and the Honda did what all Hondas must do when they are swerved sharply at low speed. It fell over. Larry ran to her, his heart in his throat. "Are you okay, Nadine? Are you..." Then she was picking herself up, examining her scraped hands. "I'm fine. Stupid me, not looking where I was going. Did I hurt the motorcycle?" "Never mind that. Let me look at your hands." She held them out. He took a plastic bottle of Bactine from his pocket and sprayed them. "You're shaking," she said. "Yes, I am. Listen, maybe we'd better just stick to the bicycles. This is dangerous." "So is breathing. And Joe can ride with you, at least at first." "He won't..." "I think he will," Nadine said calmly. "And so do you." "Well, let's stop for tonight. It's almost too dark to see." "Once more, I read someplace that if your horse throws you, you should get right back on." Joe strolled by, paying no attention to them. He was munching blueberries that he had gathered in a motorcycle helmet. "I guess so," Larry said, defeated. "But will you please watch where you're going and spare me a heart seizure?" "Yes, sir. Right, sir." She made a comic salute and smiled at him. She had a beautiful, slow smile that eventually lit up her whole face. Larry smiled back unwillingly. There was nothing else to do. This time she putted around the lot twice and then turned out into the road, swinging over too sharply and bringing Larry's heart into his mouth again. But this time the Honda let her get away with it. She went up the hill and out of sight. He saw her switch up to second gear and heard her switch to third and fourth before the bike's engine faded to a meaningless drone melting away to nothing. He stood anxiously in the twilight, waiting for her, slapping at an occasional mosquito. Joe strolled by again, his mouth blue. "Weckum," he said, and grinned. Larry managed a strained smile in return. If she didn't come back soon, he would go after her. Visions of finding her lying in a ditch with a broken neck danced blackly in his head. He was just walking over to the other cycle they had gassed up when the droning hum came to his ears again, gradually swelling to the sound of the Honda's engine. He relaxed, a little. Dismally, he realized he would never be able to relax completely while she was on that thing. She came back into sight and pulled up beside him. "Pretty good, huh?" She raced the throttle and switched off. "I was getting ready to come after you. I thought you'd had an accident." "In a manner of speaking, I did. I forgot to use the clutch when I slowed down, and I stalled it." "Oh. Enough for tonight, Nadine, okay? Please?" "Yes," she said. "My tailbone hurts." He lay in his blankets that night, wondering if she might come to him when Joe was asleep. Waiting and wondering, Larry fell asleep himself. He dreamed he was in a field of corn, lost there. But there was music, guitar music. Joe playing the guitar? If he found Joe, he would be all right. Except Joe was just what Nadine called him. The boy's real name was Leo. Leo Rockway. He followed the sound, breaking through one row of corn to the next when he had to, at last coming out in a ragged clearing. There was a small house there, more of a shack, really, the porch held up with rusty old jack lifters. It wasn't Joe playing the guitar. How could it have been? Joe was holding his left hand and Nadine his right. They were with him. An old woman was playing the guitar, playing a jazzy sort of spiritual that had Joe smiling. The old woman was black. She was sitting on the porch, and Larry guessed she was just about the oldest woman he had ever seen in his life. But there was something about her that made him feel good. Good in the way his mother had made him feel good when she would suddenly hug him and say, "Here's the best boy. Here's Alice Underwood's all-time best boy." The old woman stopped playing and looked at them. "Well, say, I got me some company. Step out where I can see you good and plain." So they came closer, the three of them hand in hand, and Joe reached out and set the bald old tire swing into slow pendulum movement as they passed it. The tire's donut-shaped shadow slipped back and forth on the earth. They were in a small clearing, an island in a sea of corn. To the north, a dirt road stretched away to a point. "You like to have a swing on this old box of mine?" she asked Joe. And Joe came forward eagerly and took the old guitar from her bunched hands. He began to play the tune they had followed through the corn, but better and faster than the old woman had. "Bless him, he plays good. Me, I'm too old. Can't make my fingers go that fast nohow. It's the rheumatiz." Nadine asked who she was. They were in a kind of forever place where the sun seemed to stand still 1 hour from darkness, and the shadow of the swing Joe had set in motion would always travel back and forth across the weedy yard. Larry wished he could stay here forever, he and his family. This was a good place. The man with no face could never get him here, or Joe, Leo, or Nadine. "Mother Abigail is what they call me. I'm the oldest woman in eastern Nebraska, I guess, and I still make my own biscuit. You come see me as quick as you can. We got to go on to the free zone and get settled before he gets wind of us. Things are going to happen awful fast, I reckon." A cloud came over the sun. The swing's arc had decreased to nothing. Joe stopped playing with a jangle of strings, and Larry felt the hackles rise on the back of his neck. The old woman seemed not to notice. "Before who gets wind of us?" Nadine asked coldly, and Larry wished he could speak, cry out for her to take the question back before it could leap free and hurt them. "I guess you know, don't you, woman?" "No, I don't know what you're talking about." "You do, but I reckon you don't know what he means for you." "No, you don't know that. We got the Rockies between us and him, praise God, but the mountains won't keep him back long. That's why we got to knit together, out in Colorado. God came to me in a dream and showed me where." "No," Nadine said in that same cold, fearful voice. "We're going to Vermont, and that's all, just a short trip." "Your trip will be longer than ours if and you don't fight off his power," the old woman in Larry's dream replied. She was looking at Nadine with great sadness. "This could be a good man you got here, woman. He wants to make something out of himself. Why don't you cleave to him instead of using him?" "No, we're going to Vermont, to Vermont." The old woman looked at Nadine pityingly. "You'll go straight to hell if you don't watch close, woman. And when you get there, you'll find that hell is cold, cold." The dream broke up then, splitting into cracks of darkness that swallowed him. But something in that darkness was stalking him. It was cold and merciless, and soon he would see its grinning teeth. But before that could happen, he was awake. It was dawn, and the world was swallowed in a thick white ground fog that would burn off when the sun got up a bit more. Someone was next to him, and he saw that it wasn't Nadine who had joined him in the night, but Joe. In the dream, Joe's name had been something else, but now he couldn't remember what. The boy lay next to him, thumb corked in his mouth, shivering in his sleep, as if his own nightmare had gripped him. Larry wondered if Joe's dreams were so different from his own, and he lay on his back, staring up into the white fog, and thinking about that until the others woke up an hour later. The fog had burned off by the time they had finished breakfast and packed their gear. As Nadine had said, Joe showed no qualms about riding behind Larry. In fact, he climbed on Larry's bike without waiting to be asked. "Slow," Larry said for the fourth time. "We're not going to hurry and have an accident." "Fine," Nadine said. "Larry, I'm excited enough just to be going." They stopped for lunch under the tree by the brook where Larry had fallen asleep. He was relieved to find that cycling wasn't nearly as bad as he had thought it might be. They were making fairly decent time, even though it was necessary to putt along the sidewalks at walking speed in the villages they came to along the way. Nadine was being extremely careful going around blind curves, and even on the open road, she didn't urge Larry to go any faster than the steady 35-miles-an-hour pace he was setting. He thought that, barring bad weather, they would be in Stovington by July 19th. They stopped for supper west of Concord, where Nadine said they could save time on Lauder and Goldsmith's route by taking I-89. "There'll be a lot of stalled traffic," Larry said doubtfully. "We can weave in and out," she said, "and use the breakdown lanes. The worst that can happen is we'll have to backtrack to the nearest exit and go around on a secondary road." They went on for 2 hours after supper, and did indeed come upon a block that was impossible to skirt. A car and trailer combination had struck a gigantic Winnebago camper. The three of them, working together, were able to hoist the bikes over the highway guardrails, trundle them past the wreck, and then hoist them back onto the turnpike. It was exhausting work, and when the block was at last behind them, there was no question of going on. They spread their blankets near the two Hondas and slept. There were no dreams that night. The following afternoon, they came to a colossal smash-up. There was no question of getting around this one. Over a dozen cars had been involved. They were only 2 miles beyond the Enfield exit, and so they didn't have far to backtrack, but all three of them were tired and discouraged. Nadine was particularly snappish because her turnpike idea hadn't worked very well. They stopped in the Enfield Town Park to rest. "What did you do before, Nadine?" Larry asked. "Did you teach?" "Yes, I did." "Little kids?" "First and second grades." That explained a lot about her attachment to Joe and her calm, efficient handling of him. "How did you guess that, Larry?" "I used to date a speech therapist from Oakland," he said. "I know that sounds like the start of some weird, dirty joke, but it's the truth. She worked for the Oakland school system, younger grades, kids with hair lips, cleft palates, deaf kids, the works. She used to say that correcting speech defects in children was just showing them alternate ways of getting certain sounds. Show them, say the word, over and over until something in the kid's head clicked. And when she talked about the click happening, she looked the way you did when Joe said, 'You're welcome.'" "Did I?" She smiled a little wistfully. "I love the little ones. Some of my kids were bruised, but none of them were spoiled, not irrevocably. The little ones are the only good human beings."
"Do you believe that?"
"Children are good. If you work with them, you get to be a romantic. That's not so bad. Wasn't your speech therapist friend happy with her work?"
"Yeah, she liked it."
"Were you married, Nadine?"
"Married? No, never married."
She looked down at her hands, which were plucking grass nervously. "I'm the original old maid schoolteacher, younger than I look, but older than I feel. 37. She touched her white-streaked hair. "Premature. My grandmother's hair was completely white by the time she was 40. I think I'm going to last 5 years longer." "Where did you teach?"
"Pittsfield, a small private school, very exclusive. Ivy-covered walls, all the latest playground equipment. The carpool was 2 Thunderbirds, one of them a 1957. 3 Mercedes, a couple of Lincolns, and a Chrysler Imperial. Damn the energy crisis, full speed ahead."
"You must have been good."
"I was," she said, and smiled. "But it doesn't matter now." He put an arm around her, and she stiffened.
"I wish you wouldn't."
"You don't want me to?"
"No, I don't."
He drew his arm back, baffled. She did want him to, that was the thing. He could feel her wanting coming off her in waves. Her color was very high now, and she was looking desperately down at her hands, which had uprooted a drift of grass. Her eyes were shiny, on the verge of tears.
"Nadine, honey, is that you?"
She looked up and saw that she was past the verge. She was crying. She was about to speak when Joe strolled up, carrying his guitar case. They looked at him guiltily, as if they had been discovered doing something rather more personal than talking.
"Lady," Joe said conversationally.
"What?" Larry asked, startled and not tracking very well.
"Lady."
Joe jerked his thumb back over his shoulder. Larry and Nadine looked at each other. Suddenly there was a new voice, high-pitched and choking with emotion, almost as startling as the voice of God.
"Thank heaven," it cried. "Oh, thank heaven."
They stood up and saw a woman half running up the street toward them. She was smiling and crying at the same time.
"I'm so glad to see you," she said. "Thank heaven."
She swayed and might have fainted if Larry hadn't been there to steady her until her dizziness passed. Larry guessed her age at 25. She was dressed in jeans and a plain white cotton blouse. Her blue eyes stared desperately at Larry, as if trying to convince the brain behind them that this was not a hallucination, that the three people she saw were really here. "I'm Larry Underwood. The lady is Nadine Cross. The boy is Joe. We're all very happy to meet you." The woman continued to stare at him wordlessly for a moment, and then walked slowly away from him and toward Nadine.
"I'm so pleased," she began. "So pleased to meet you."
She stumbled a little.
"Oh, my God, are you really people?"
"Yes," Nadine said. The woman put her arms around Nadine and sobbed. Nadine held her. Joe stood in the street by a stalled pickup truck, his guitar case in one hand, his thumb in his mouth. At last he went to Larry, and Larry held his hand. The two of them watched the woman solemnly. Her name was Lucy Swan, and she was eager to go with them to Stovington and excited at the prospect of meeting Harold and Francis. Larry found a knapsack for her, and Nadine went with her to her house to help her pack. 2 changes of clothes, an extra pair of shoes, a raincoat, and pictures of her late husband and daughter. They camped that night in Keechee, now over the state line and into Vermont. Lucy told them her story. It was not much different from the others they would hear. Her husband and daughter had died within a day of each other. She nursed them as best she could, and when they were gone, she waited to catch it and die herself. By July 3rd, she was the only living soul in Enfield, New Hampshire. "Wes and me, we had to get married," Lucy said. "That was the summer of 74, just after I graduated high school. My mom and dad didn't want me to marry him. They wanted me to go away to have the baby and then give her up. But I wouldn't. My mom said it would end in a divorce. My dad said Wes was just a no-account, shiftless man. I said, maybe, we'll see. And we settled down real good, the three of us. It was more Marcy than me that settled Wes down. He thought the sun rose and set on that baby." With a sigh that was more than half a sob, she said, "I sure never thought it would end like this." "No one did, Lucy," Larry said.
"I guess I could have gotten along. I was, until I started having all those bad dreams."
Larry's head jerked up.
"Dreams?"
Joe was also looking at her. A moment before, he had been nodding out, but now he was staring at Lucy, his eyes gleaming.
"Bad dreams, nightmares," Lucy said. "They're not always the same. Mostly it's a man chasing me, and I can never see exactly what he looks like because he's all wrapped up in a cloak. And he stays in the shadows in the alleys. I got so I was afraid to go to sleep. But now maybe I'll..."
"Brackman!" Joe cried suddenly. So fiercely, they all jumped. He leaped to his feet and held his arms out like a miniature Bela Lugosi, his fingers hooked into claws.
"Brackman! Bad dreams! Bad cares! Cares me!"
"Scares me, that's what he's trying to say," Larry thought. "Bad dreams, bad scares. Joe, I couldn't agree more."
"This is crazy," he said aloud, and then stopped.
They were all looking at him. Suddenly the darkness seemed very dark indeed, and Lucy looked frightened again.
"Lucy, do you ever dream about, well, a place in Nebraska?"
"I had a dream one night about an old Negro woman," she said, "but it didn't last very long. She said something like, 'You come see me.' Then I was back in Enfield, and that scary guy was chasing me. Then I woke up."
Larry looked at her so long that she colored and dropped her eyes. He looked at Joe.
"Joe, do you ever dream about, corn? An old woman? A guitar?"
Joe only looked at him from Nadine's encircling arm.
"Leave him alone. You'll upset him more," Nadine said. But she was the one who sounded upset. "A house, Joe? A little house with the porch up on Jack's?"
He thought he saw a gleam in Joe's eyes.
"Stop it, Larry," Nadine said.
Inspiration struck.
"A swing, Joe.
A swing made out of a tire.
Joe jerked in Nadine's arms. She tried to hold him, but he broke through.
The swing, Joe said exultantly. The swing, the swing.
He whirled away from them and pointed first at Nadine, then at Larry, then at Lucy.
Her, you, lots.
Lucy Swan looked stunned.
The swing, she said. I remember that, too.
She looked at Larry, scared.
Why are we all having the same dream? How can that be? Is someone using a ray on us?
I don't know. He looked at Nadine. Have you had them, too? I don't dream, she said. But she wouldn't meet his eyes.
Are you sure?
I told you, I don't dream. Her voice was sharp, nearly hysterical.
Can't you just leave me alone? Do you have to badger me?
She got up and left the fire, almost running. Lucy looked after her uncertainly for a moment, and then stood up.
I'll go after her.
Yeah, you better. Thanks, Lucy. She came back with Nadine shortly. They had both been crying, Larry saw, but they seemed to be on good terms now.
I'm sorry, Nadine said. It's just that I'm always upset. It comes out in funny ways, I guess, and I'm tired.
The subject did not come up again. They sat and listened to Joe run through his repertoire. He was getting very good indeed now, and in with the hootings and grunts, fragments of the lyrics were coming through. At last they slept, Larry on one end, Nadine on the other, Joe and Lucy between. He dreamed first of the black man on the high rooftop, looking east, then of the old woman sitting on her porch. Only in this dream he knew that the man with no face was coming, striding through the corn, knocking his own twisted swathe through the corn, his terrible hot grin tattooed to his face, coming toward them, coming closer. Larry woke up in the middle of the night, out of breath, his chest constricted with terror. The others slept like stones. Somehow in that dream he had known that the black man was not coming empty-handed. In his arms, borne like an offering, he had held the decaying body of Rita Blakemore, now stiff and swollen, her flesh ripped by weasels. A mute accusation to be thrown at his feet, a putrid offering that would scream his guilt to the others, to silently proclaim that he wasn't no nice guy, never had been, never would be. The old woman on one side, the black man on the other, he thought, already turning to sleep again, and all the rest of us somewhere between, on the border, choosing up sides. Then he slept again, and his sleep was silent darkness, undisturbed.
Oh, God,
Nadine said emptily. Larry looked at her face and saw a disappointment too deep for tears. Her face was pale, her remarkable eyes clouded and dull. It was the evening of July 19th, and the shadows were drawing long. The four of them stood together in a line outside a wrought iron fence. Below and behind them lay the town of Stovington, not much changed from the way Stu Redman had seen it on his last day of captivity. Beyond the fence and a lawn that had once been well kept, but which was now getting shaggy and littered by sticks and leaves that had blown onto it during afternoon thunderstorms, was the plague center itself, three stories high, who knew how much more underground. The place was deserted, silent, empty. In the center of the lawn, a large sign had been erected. Route 7 to Rutland, Route 4 to Schuylerville, Route 29 to I-87, I-87 to I-90, I-90 West. Everyone here is dead. We are moving west to Nebraska. Stay on our route. Watch for signs. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith, Stuart Redman, Glenn Bateman, July 8, 1980. Harold, my man, Larry murmured. Can't wait to shake your hand and buy you a beer. Or a payday. Larry, Lucy said sharply. Nadine had fainted. Chapter 36. She tottered out onto her porch at 20 to 11 on the morning of July 20th, carrying her coffee and her toast with her, as she did every day that the Coca-Cola thermometer outside the sink window read over 50 degrees. It was high summer, the finest summer Mother Abigail could recollect since 1950, the year her mother had died at the goodish age of 93. "Too bad there ain't more folks around to enjoy it," she thought as she sat carefully down in her armless rocking chair. But did they ever enjoy it? Some did, of course. Young folks in love did, and old folks whose bones remembered so clearly what the death clutch of winter was. Now most of the young folks and old folks were gone, and most of those in between. God had brought down a harsh judgment on the human race. Some might argue with such a harsh judgment, but Mother Abigail was not among their number. He had done it once with water, and sometime further along he would do it with fire. Her place was not to judge God, although she wished he hadn't seen fit to set the cup before her lips that he had. But when it came to matters of judgment, she was satisfied with the answer God had given Moses from the burning bush, when Moses had seen fit to question. "Who are you?" Moses asks. And God comes back from that bush just as pert as you like. "I am who I am." "In other words, Mose, stop beating around this here bush and get your old ass in gear." She wheezed laughter and nodded her head and dipped her toast into the wide mouth of her coffee cup until it was soft enough to chew. It had been 16 years since she had bid hail and farewell to her last tooth. Toothless she had come from her mother's womb, and toothless she would go into her own grave. Molly, her great-granddaughter, and her husband had given her a set of false teeth for Mother's Day just a year later, the year she herself had been 93. But they hurt her gums, and now she only wore them when she knew Molly and Jim were coming. Then she would take them from the box in the drawer and rinse them off good and stick them in. And if she had time before Molly and Jim came, she would make faces at herself in the spotty kitchen mirror and growl through all those big white fake teeth and laugh fit to split. She looked like an old black Everglades gator. She was old and feeble, but her mind was pretty much in order. Abigail Freemantle was her name, born in 1872, and with the birth certificate to prove it. She'd seen a heap during her time on the earth, but nothing to match the goings-on of the last month or so. No, there had never been such a thing, and now her time was coming to be a part of it, and she hated it. She was old. She wanted to rest and enjoy the cycle of the seasons between now and whenever God got tired of watching her make her daily round and decided to call her home to glory. But what happened when you questioned God? The answer you got was, "I am who I am." And that was the end. When his own son prayed that the cup be taken from his lips, God never even answered. And she wasn't up to that snuff, no how, no way. Just an ordinary sinner was all she was, and it scared her to think that God had looked down at a little baby girl poking out between her mother's legs back in the spring of 1872, and had said to himself, "I got to keep her around a goodish time. She's got work in 1980, on the other side of a whole heap of calendar pages." Her time here in Hemmingford home was coming to an end, and her final season of work lay ahead of her in the west, near the Rocky Mountains. He had sent Moses to mountain climbing and Noah to boat building. He had seen his own son nailed up on a tree. What did he care how miserably afraid Abby Freemantle was of the man with no face? He who stalked her dreams. She never saw him. She didn't have to see him. He was a shadow passing through the corn at noon, a cold pocket of air, a gore crow peering down at you from the phone lines. His voice called to her in all the sounds that had ever frightened her. Soft, it was the tick of a death watch beetle under the stairs, telling her that someone loved would soon pass over. Spoken loud, it was the afternoon thunder rolling amid the clouds that came out of the west like boiling Armageddon. And sometimes there was no sound at all but the lonely rustle of the night wind in the corn. But she would know he was there, and that was the worst of all. Because then the man with no face seemed only a little less than God himself. At those times it seemed that she was within touching distance of the dark angel that had flown silently over Egypt, killing the firstborn of every house where the doorpost wasn't daubed with blood.
That frightened her most of all. She became a child again in her fear, and knew that while others knew of him, and were frightened by him, only she had been given a clear vision of his terrible power. "Well-a-day," she said, and popped the last bite of toast into her mouth. She rocked back and forth, drinking her coffee. This was a bright, fine day, and no part of her body was giving her a particular misery, and she offered up a brief prayer of thanksgiving for what she had got. God is great, God is good. The littlest child could learn those words, and they encompassed the whole world and all the world held, good and evil. God is great, Mother Abigail said. God is good. Thank you for the sunshine, for the coffee, for that fine BM I had last night. You was right, those dates turned the trick. But my God, they taste nasty to me. Ain't I the one? God is great. Her coffee was about gone. She set the cup down and rocked, her face turned up to the sun like some strange living rock face seamed with veins of coal. She dozed, then slept. Her heart, its walls now almost as thin as tissue paper, beat on and on as it had every minute for the last 39,475 days. Like a baby in a crib, you would have had to put your hand on her chest to assure yourself that she was breathing at all. But the smile stayed on. Things had surely changed in all the years since she had been a girl. The Fremantles had come to Nebraska as freed slaves, and Abigail's own great-granddaughter Molly laughed in a nasty, cynical way and suggested the money Abby's father had used to buy the home place, money paid to him by Sam Fremantle of Lewis, South Carolina, as wages for the 3 years her daddy and his brothers had stayed on after the state's war ended, had been conscience money. Abigail had held her tongue when Molly said that. Molly and Jim and the others were young and didn't understand anything but the veriest good and the veriest bad. But inside, she had rolled her eyes and said to herself, "Conscience money? Well, is there any money cleaner than that?" So the Fremantles had settled in Hemmingford home, and Abby, the last of Daddy and Mama's children, had been born right here on the home place. Her father had bested those who would not buy from niggers and those who would not sell to them. He had bought land a little smidge at a time so as not to alarm those who were worried about those black bastards over Columbus way. He had been the first man in Polk County to try crop rotation, the first man to try chemical fertilizer. And in March of 1895, Gary Seitz had come to the house to tell John Fremantle that he had been voted into the Grange. He was the first black man to belong to the Grange in the whole state of Nebraska. That year had been a topper. And little by little he had brought his neighbors around. Not all of them, not the rabid ones like Ben Convey and his half-brother George, not the Arnolds and the Deacons, but all the others. In 1897 they had taken dinner with Gary Seitz and his family, right in the parlor, just as good as white. In 1895 Abigail had played her guitar at the Grange Hall, and not in the minstrel show either. She had played in the White Folks Talent Show at the end of the year. Her mother had been dead set against that. "I know how it was," she said, weeping. "You and Seitz and that Frank Fenner, you whipped this up together. That's fine for them, John Fremantle, but what's got into your head? They're white. You go hunker down with them in the backyard and talk about plowing. You can even go downtown and have a spot of beer with them if that Nate Jackson will let you into his saloon. Fine. But this is different. This is your own daughter. What you going to say if she gets up there in her pretty white dress and they laughs at her? What you going to do if they throws rotten tomatoes at her, huh?" "Well, Rebecca," John had answered, "I guess we better leave it up to her and David." David had been her first husband. In 1895, Abigail Fremantle had become Abigail Trotz. David Trotz was a black farmhand from over Valparaiso way, and he had come pretty nearly 30 miles one way to court her. John Fremantle had once said to Rebecca that the bear had caught old Davy right and proper, and he had been trotting plenty. There were plenty who had laughed at her first husband and said things like, "I guess I know who wears the pants in that family." But David had not been a weakling, only quiet and thoughtful. When he told John and Rebecca Fremantle, "Whatever Abigail thinks is right, why, I reckon that's what's to do,"
She had blessed him for it, and told her mother and father she intended to go ahead. So on December 27, 1895, already 3 months gone with her first, she had mounted the Grange Hall stage in the dead silence that had ensued when the Master of Ceremonies had announced her name. Just before her, Gretchen Tillians had been on and had done a racy French dance, showing her ankles and petticoats to the raucous whistles, cheers, and stamping feet of the men in the audience. She stood in the thick silence, knowing how black her face and neck must look in her new white dress, and her heart was thudding terribly in her chest, and she was thinking, "I forgot every word, every single word. I promised Daddy I wouldn't cry no matter what. I wouldn't cry. But Ben Convey's out there, and when Ben Convey yells nigger, then I guess I'll cry. Oh, why did I ever get into this? Mama was right. I've got above my place, and I'll pay for it." The hall was filled with white faces turned up to look at her. Every chair was filled, and there were 2 rows of standees at the back of the hall. Kerosene lanterns glowed and flared. The red velvet curtains were pulled back in swoops of cloth and tied with gold ropes. And she thought, "I'm Abigail Freemantle Trotz. I play well and I sing well. I do not know these things because anyone told me." And so she began to sing "The Old Rugged Cross" into the moveless silence, her fingers picking melody. Then, picking up a strum, the slightly stronger melody of "How I Love My Jesus," and then, stronger still, "Camp Meeting in Georgia." Now people were swaying back and forth almost in spite of themselves. Some were grinning and tapping their knees. She sang a medley of Civil War songs. "When Johnny Comes Marching Home," "Marching Through Georgia," and "Goober Pease." More smiles at that one. Many of these men, Grand Army of the Republic veterans, had eaten more than a few goober pease during their time in the service. She finished with "Tenting Tonight on the Old Campground," and as the last chord floated away into a silence that was now thoughtful and sad, she thought, "Now if you want to throw your tomatoes or whatever, you go on and do it. I played and sang my best, and I was real fine." Then someone in the middle of the audience, her father told her later it was Gary Seitz, began to applaud. Someone else joined him. And then they were all applauding, except for Ben Convey and his half-brother. And she stood there with tears sparkling on her cheeks as they stood up, applauding fit to raise the roof. That was the proudest day of her life. Later, she paused in the middle of the yard, looking out at the sea of corn, broken only by the dirt road going north toward Duncan and Columbus. 3 miles up from her house, it went to tar. The corn was going to be fine this year, and it was such a shame that no one would be around to harvest it but rooks. It was sad to think that the big red harvesting machines were going to stay in their barns this September. Sad to think there would be no husking bees and barn dances. Sad to think that, for the first time in the last 108 years, she would not be here in Hemingford home to see the time of the change, as summer gave in to pagan, jocund autumn. She would love this summer all the more because it was to be her last. She felt that clearly. And she would not be laid to rest here, but further west, in a strange country. It was bitter. She shuffled over to the tire swing and set it to moving. It was an old tractor tire that her brother Lucas had hung here in 1922. The rope had been changed many times between then and now, but never the tire. Now the canvas showed through in many places, and on the inside rim there was a deep depression where generations of young buttocks had set themselves down. Below the tire was a deep and dusty groove in the earth where the grass had long since given up trying to grow, and on the limb where the rope was tied, the bark had been rubbed away to show the branch's white bone. The rope creaked slowly, and this time she spoke aloud. "Please, my lord, not unless I have to. I'm old and I'm scared, and mostly I'd just like to die right here on the home place. I'm ready to go right now if you want me. Thy will be done, my lord, but Ab's one tired, shuffling old black woman. Thy will be done." No sound but the creak of the rope against the branch and the crows off in the corn. She put her old seamed forehead against the old seamed bark of the apple tree her father had planted so long ago, and she wept bitterly. She had a great deal to do in the next few days, because she was going to have company. Dreams or not, tired or not, she had never been a one to slight company, and she didn't intend to start now. But she would have to go very slowly, or she would be forgetting things. She forgot a lot these days, and misplacing things until she ended up chasing her own tail. The first thing was to get down to Addie Richardson's hen house, and that was a goodish way, 4 or 5 miles. She found herself wondering if the Lord was going to send her an eagle to fly her those 4 miles, or send along Elijah in his fiery chariot to give her a lift. Blasphemy, she told herself complacently. The Lord provides strength, not taxicabs. When her few dishes were washed, she put on her heavy shoes and took her cane. Even now she rarely used the cane, but today she would need it. 4 miles going, 4 miles coming back. At 16, she could have dashed one way and trotted the other, but she'd not see 16 again. She set off at 8 o'clock in the morning, hoping to reach the Richardson farm by noon and sleep through the hottest part of the day. In the late afternoon, she would kill her chickens and then come home in the gloaming. She wouldn't arrive until after dark, and that made her think of her dream of the night before. But that man was still far away. Her company was much closer. She walked very slowly, even more slowly than she felt she had to, because even at 8:30 the sun was fat and powerful. But still, she had to rest a bit by the time she reached the Goodells' place. She sat in the shade of their pepper tree for a bit and ate a few fig bars. Not an eagle or a taxicab in sight, either. She cackled a little at that, got up, brushed off her dress, and went on. She hunched more and more over her cane as she went, even though her wrists began to be a misery to her. She wanted a drink of water. She wanted to be home in a rocker. She wanted to be left alone. Now she could see the sun glinting off the henhouse roof ahead to her left. A mile, no more. It was 10:15, and she wasn't doing too badly for an old gal. She would let herself in and sleep until the cool of the evening. No sin in that. Not at her age. In 1972, when she had turned 100, her picture had been in the Omaha paper, and they had sent out a TV reporter to do a story on her. "To what do you attribute your great age?" the young man had asked her. And he had looked disappointed at her brief, almost curt answer. "To God." They wanted to hear about how she ate beeswax, or stayed away from fried pork, or how she kept her legs up when she slept. But she did none of those things, and was she to lie? God gives life, and he takes it away when he wants. The Richardson place was closer now. Lord, how she wanted to lie down and take off her shoes and have a nap. Abby shuffled slowly on. The sun was shining in the window of the guest bedroom where she had lain down and fallen asleep as soon as her brogans were off. For a long time, she couldn't understand why the light was so bright. It was much the feeling Larry Underwood had had upon awakening beside the rock wall in New Hampshire. She sat up, every strained muscle and fragile bone in her body crying out. "God Almighty, I done slept the afternoon and the whole night through." If that was so, she must have been tired indeed. She was so lamed up now that it took her almost 10 minutes to get out of bed and go down the hall to the bathroom. Another 10 to get her shoes on her feet. Walking was agony, but she knew she must walk. If she didn't, that stiffness would settle in like iron. Limping and hobbling, she crossed to the henhouse and went inside, wincing at the explosive hotness, the smell of fowls, and the inevitable smell of decomposition. The water supply was automatic, fed from the Richardson's artesian well by a gravity pump, but most of the feed had been used up, and the heat itself had killed many of the birds. The weakest had long ago been starved or pecked to death, and they lay around the feed and droppings' spotted floor like small drifts of sadly melting snow.